Chapter 9. Sloane McIntyre wore a baseball cap to tame her hair against the 20-knot wind generated by the fishing boat's forward speed. Her eyes were protected by a pair of wraparound Oakleys on a gaily colored cord, and what skin lay exposed to the sun was slathered with SPF 30. She had on a pair of khaki shorts and a loose bush shirt festooned with pockets. On her feet, she wore canvas boat shoes. The glint of a gold anklet shone in the sun. Every time she was on the water, she felt like a teen again, working her father's charter boat off Florida's east coast. There had been a few bad incidences when she'd taken over for her ailing father, with drunken fishermen more interested in catching her than billfish or snapper, but all in all, it was the greatest time of her life. The salty tang of sea air seemed to calm her very soul, while the isolation of being on a hard-charging boat helped her focus her mind. The charter boat captain, a jovial Namibian, sensed in her a kindred spirit, and when she glanced at him, he threw her a knowing smile. Sloane returned it. With the twin Cummins diesels bellowing under the transom, it was nearly impossible to speak, so he stood from his chair and gestured for Sloane to take the controls. Her smile turned into a grin. The captain tapped the compass to indicate their heading and stepped from the wheel. Sloane slid into his position and rested her hands lightly on the worn wheel. He stood by her side for a couple of minutes, checking that their wake continued in a straight line. Satisfied that he was right about his passenger being able to handle the 46-foot cruiser, he slid down the short ladder, nodded at Tony Reardon, who was slouched in the fighting chair, and went to use the head. Sloane would have given up on their search if those men hadn't come after her the previous night. Their actions convinced her she was on the right track to find the HMS Rove. Why else try to scare her off? She hadn't told Tony about the attack, but first thing this morning she'd phoned her boss and laid out the whole story. While concerned for her safety, he gave her permission to extend their stay another day so they could investigate the section of sea where Papa Heinrich had seen his giant metal snakes. She knew she was being reckless. Any sane person would have heeded the warning and left the country on the first plane out, but that wasn't in her nature. In all her life, she had never left a task unfinished. No matter how bad a book was, she'd read it to the last word. No matter how difficult a crossword, she'd work it to the last clue. No matter how difficult the job, she would see it through to the end. It was this dogged tenacity that probably kept her in doomed relationships long after she should have ended them. But it also gave her the strength to face whoever was trying to prevent her from finding her ship. Sloane had been cautious when hiring the charter, making sure the captain wasn't one they had spoken to when she and Tony were putting together their map. Leaving their hotel, they had blended in with a large group of tourists who were headed to the waterfront for a charter fishing trip of their own, and on the bus she made certain that no one was following them. Had she seen anything suspicious, she would have called off the whole thing, but no one paid their vehicle any attention. It was only when they were several miles from shore that Sloane told the captain where she really wanted to go. He'd told her that the section of the sea where she wanted to fish was devoid of any marine life, but since she was paying, he hadn't put up much of an argument. That had been 6 uneventful hours earlier, and every mile they put behind them without incident allowed Sloane to relax that little bit more. The men who had chased her must have assumed they had taken their warning to heart and given up. The seas were building slightly with a wind out of the south. The beamy boat rode them well, rolling to starboard with each swell and returning to an even keel smartly. The captain returned from below and stood a little behind Sloane, letting her maintain the helm. He reached for a pair of binoculars from under a bench seat and scanned the horizon. He handed them to her and pointed a bit south of due west. Sloane adjusted the binoculars to fit her face and brought them to her eyes. A big ship coasted on the horizon, a single funneled freighter that appeared to be heading toward Walvis Bay. At this extreme range, it was impossible to see any detail other than get a vague sense of her dark hull and a small forest of booms and derricks on both her fore and aft decks. "I never see a ship like that out here before," the charter captain said. "Only ships come to Walvis are coasters or the cruise ships. Fishermen are all closer to shore, and tankers rounding the cape run 400 or 500 miles further out." The world's oceans are divided into sea lanes that were almost as clearly marked as interstate highways. With deadlines always tight and the price of keeping a vessel at sea running into the hundreds of thousands of dollars a day for supertankers, ships invariably followed the straightest line between destinations, rarely varying a mile or two. So while some parts of the ocean teemed with marine traffic, other regions never saw a single ship in a year. The charter boat was in such a dead zone. Far enough from the coast to avoid regional freighters supplying Walvis Bay, but well inside established routes used for rounding the Cape of Good Hope. "There's something else odd," Sloane said. "There's no smoke coming from her funnel. Do you think she's a derelict? Maybe she was caught in a storm and the crew had to abandon her." Tony came up the ladder. Sloane was pondering the presence of the mystery ship and the fate of her crew and didn't hear him, so when he touched her shoulder, she started. "Sorry," he said. "Look behind us. There's another boat coming this way." Sloane whirled so fast that her hands on the wheel caused the boat to lurch to port. It was notoriously hard to judge distances at sea, but she knew the boat driving hard for them could be more than a couple of miles astern, and for it to catch up to them, it was running faster than the charter boat. She tossed the binoculars at the captain and eased the chrome throttle handles until they hit their stops. "What's going on?" Tony shouted, leaning forward as the boat picked up speed. The captain had sensed Sloane's fear and for the moment said nothing as he scoped the approaching craft with the binoculars. "Do you recognize it?" Sloane asked him.
"Yes. She comes into Walvis every month or so. A yacht. Maybe 50 feet long. I do not know her name or her owner."
"Can you see anyone?"
"There are men on the upper bridge. White men."
"I demand to know what is going on," Tony roared, his face flushing. Again, Sloane ignored him. Without having to see them, she knew who was in the boat behind them. She gently eased the wheel and started racing for the distant freighter, praying that her pursuers would back off if there were witnesses. Out on the open ocean, she was sure they'd be killed. The fishing boat scuttled. She pressed more firmly on the throttles, but the diesels were already giving her everything they had. Her lips worked as she silently prayed that she was wrong about the freighter being abandoned. If it was, they'd be dead as soon as the yacht caught up. Tony grabbed her arm, his eyes blazing. "Damn it, Sloane, what is this all about? Who are those people?" "I think they're the same men who chased me back to the hotel last night."
"Chased you? What do you mean, chased you?"
"What I said," she snapped. "I was chased back to the hotel by 2 men. One of them had a gun. They warned me to leave the country." Tony's anger turned into fury, and even the captain looked at her with an unreadable expression.
"And you didn't see fit to tell me? Are you out of your mind? You get chased by men with guns and then lead us out here to the middle of nowhere? Good God, woman, what were you thinking?"
"I didn't think they would follow us," Sloane shouted back. "I messed up, all right? If we can get close enough to the freighter, they won't do anything."
"What the hell would have happened if that freighter wasn't here?"
Spittle popped from Tony's mouth with each word.
"Well, it is, so we'll be fine."
Tony turned to the ship's owner.
"Do Do you have a gun?
He nodded slowly. I use it on sharks if they come round.
Then I bloody well recommend you get it, mate, because we might just need it.
The boat had been taking the waves on a gentle broadside, but now that Sloane had altered their course, they were cutting into them, the bow sawing up and down and sea foam exploding each time they plowed through a crest. The ride was rough, and Sloane kept her knees bent to absorb each impact. The captain returned from below and wordlessly handed Sloane a worn 12-gauge and a fistful of shells, intuitively knowing she possessed a strength Tony Reardon lacked. He retook his position at the helm and made subtle corrections as each wave passed under them so as not to lose speed. The luxury yacht had gained at least a mile while the freighter looked no closer. She scanned the big cargo ship through the binoculars and her heart sank. The vessel was in poor repair. Her hull was painted in myriad dark shades and looked like it had been patched with steel plates a dozen times over. She saw no one walking the decks or manning the bridge, and while it looked like foam creamed off her bows as if she were making way, it couldn't be possible, because there was no smoke from her stack.
"Do you have a radio?" Sloane asked the captain.
"It is below," he replied. "But doesn't have enough range to reach Walvis, if that's what you're thinking."
Sloane pointed to the freighter over the bow.
"I want to alert them what's happening so they can lower a boarding ladder."
The captain glanced over his shoulder at the fast-approaching yacht.
"It will be close."
Sloane slid down the steep steps using just her hands and ran into the cabin. The radio was an old transceiver bolted to the low ceiling. She powered it up and worked the knob to channel 16, the International Distress Band.
"Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is the fishing vessel Pinguine calling the freighter en route to Walvis Bay. We are being chased by pirates. Please respond."
A burst of static filled the cabin. Sloane adjusted the radio dial and thumbed the microphone.
"This is the Pinguine calling unidentified freighter en route to Walvis. We need assistance. Please respond."
Again she heard static, but thought she caught the ghost of a voice in the white noise. Despite the boat's violent pitching, Sloane's fingers were as delicate as a surgeon's as she moved the dial in fractional increments. A voice suddenly boomed from the speaker. "You should have listened to me last night and left Namibia." Through the distortion, Sloane was still able to recognize the voice from the previous night, and her blood went cold. Sloane mashed the microphone.
"Leave us alone and we will return to shore," she pleaded. "I will be on the first plane out, I promise."
That is no longer an option. She looked over the transom. The yacht had cut the distance to a couple hundred yards, close enough for her to see two of the men in the bridge holding rifles of some sort. The freighter was a mile or more away. They weren't going to make it.
"What do you think, Chairman?" Hali Kasim asked from his seat at the communication station.
Cabrillo was leaning forward in his chair, an elbow on the arm of his chair, a hand cupping his unshaven chin. The forward display screen showed the view from the mast-mounted camera. The image from the gyro-stabilized video was rock-solid and zoomed in on the two boats fast approaching the Oregon. The fishing boat was making a solid 20 knots, while the motor yacht was easily closing in at 35. They'd been watching the two craft on radar for the better part of an hour and had given their presence a low priority since the waters off Namibia's coast were known fishing grounds. It was only when the first boat, which they now knew was called Pinguine, German for penguin, altered course to intercept the Oregon, that Cabrillo was called from his cabin where he was just about ready to hit the showers after an hour in the gym.
"I don't have the foggiest idea," Juan said at last. "Why would pirates use a million-dollar yacht to chase an old fishing boat 150 miles offshore? Something's hinky."
"Weps, zoom in on that yacht. Let's see who's aboard her if you can."
Mark Murphy wasn't on duty, so the crewman manning the weapons station worked a joystick and trackball to bring up the image Cabrillo wanted. At such extreme zoom, even the computer-assisted gyroscopes had a difficult time holding the picture steady. But it was good enough. Sunlight glinted off the expanse of sloping glass below the bridge, but through the glare, Juan could see four men on the sleek yacht's bridge, and two of them held assault rifles. As they watched, one of them brought the weapon to his shoulder and fired a short burst. Anticipating the coming order, the weapons officer panned back to show the fleeing Pinguine. It didn't appear she had been hit, but they could see a copper-haired woman crouched behind the flat transom, cradling a shotgun. "Weps," Cabrillo said sharply. "Spool up the Gatling, but don't lower the hull plate. Bring up a firing solution on that yacht and pop the starboard 30 calibers from the redoubts just in case." Four men with automatic weapons against a woman with a shotgun, Holly mused. "Won't be much of a fight if we don't do something." "I'm working on it," Cabrillo said, then nodded to his communications specialist. "Patch me through to her." Kasim hit a button on one of his three keyboards. "You're live." Cabrillo settled his lip mic. "Pinguine, Pinguine, Pinguine, this is the motorship Oregon." On the screen, they could see the woman's head whip around as she heard him over the radio. She scrambled back inside the cabin, and a moment later, her breathless voice filled the operations center. "Oregon, oh, thank God. For a minute, I thought you were a derelict ship." "Not far from the truth," Linda Ross deadpanned. Though not on duty, Juan had asked the elfin Ross to join him in the op center on the off chance he would need her background in intelligence. "Please state the nature of your emergency," Juan requested, pretending they didn't have a bird's-eye view of what was happening. "You mentioned pirates."
"Yes, and they just opened fire on us with machine guns. My name is Sloane McIntyre. We're on a fishing charter, and they just suddenly appeared."
"Didn't sound that way to me," Linda said, sucking her lower lip. "The guy on the yacht said he'd already warned her about something once." "So she's lying," Juan agreed. "She was just fired at, and she's lying. Interesting, don't you think? She's got to be hiding something."
"Oregon," Sloane called. "Are you still there?"
Juan keyed the mic.
"We're still here."
He sized up the situation with a quick glance at the screen, projecting where each craft would be in another minute and then their locations in two. The tactical picture was grim, but worse than that was the fact he'd be acting blind. For all he knew, Sloane McIntyre was the biggest drug dealer in southern Africa and was about to be greased by a rival. She and the others on the Pinguine might be getting everything they deserved. On the other hand, she could be totally innocent.
"Then why lie?"
he whispered to himself. If he was to preserve the Oregon's secrets, the margin for action would be razor tight. In fact, too tight. He thought through a dozen scenarios in the time it took to scratch his chin again and made his decision.
"Helm, bring us hard to starboard. We need to cut the distance between us and the Pinguine. Increase speed to 20 knots. Engineering, make sure the smudge boiler is online."
When alone at sea, the Oregon produced no pollution, but when they encountered traffic, a special smoke generator was switched on to create the illusion the remarkable ship was powered by conventional diesel engines. "I fired it up a couple minutes ago," the second engineer reported from the back of the op center. "Should have done it as soon as they reached visual range, but I forgot."
"No big deal."
"I doubt anyone noticed," Juan said before activating his mic. "Sloane, this is the master of the Oregon."
"Go ahead, Oregon."
Juan marveled at how coolly she was handling herself and thought briefly of Tori Ballinger, an Englishwoman he'd rescued a few months back in the Sea of Japan. They had the same kind of metal.
"We have turned to intercept you. Tell the Pinguine's captain to take us down the port side, but don't let on that's the way you're going to go. I want to trick the yacht to pass us to starboard. Do you understand?"
We are to pass you down your port side, but only at the last minute.
That's right. Don't cut it too close, though. The yacht won't be able to make tight turns at the speed she's doing, so avoid our bow wave as best you can. I'm going to lower our boarding stairs, but don't approach them until I give you the word. Got it?
We won't approach until you signal, Sloan repeated.
You're going to be fine, Sloan, Juan said, the confidence in his voice carrying over the crackling radio link. These aren't the first pirates me and my crew have come across.
On screen, he saw the gunmen trying to rake the penguin again with their assault rifles, but the range was still extreme from such an unstable firing platform. It didn't look like any of the rounds came close to the charter boat, yet it firmed Juan's resolve that they were doing the right thing in helping Sloan and her party.
Holly, get some hands on deck to lower the boarding stairs and extend the ladder. Weps, be prepared to fire the bow 30 caliber.
I have it locked on.
The Penguin was coming on gamely, now less than 300 yards from the hulking freighter, with the yacht a scant 100 yards further back. Juan didn't want to use the machine gun, but he saw there wasn't going to be any choice. The charter boat would be in range of the yacht before he could slip the Oregon between them. He was about to order the weapons officer to fire a short burst to slow the yacht when he noticed Sloan slithering out to the Penguin's stern. She raised her head and shoulders above the transom and let loose with the shotgun, firing the second barrel as soon as she regained her sight picture. She had no chance of hitting the yacht, but the unexpected volley forced the luxury craft to slow and make a more cautious approach. It bought her the seconds they needed to implement Cabrillo's plan.
"What's going on?" Max Hanley appeared at Cabrillo's side, smelling of pipe tobacco.
I'm trying to enjoy my day off while you're up here playing chicken with what? An old fishing boat and a floating bordello?
Juan had stopped wondering years ago how Hanley's sixth sense brought him out of his cabin when trouble was brewing.
The guys on the yacht want the people on the fishing boat dead, and it doesn't look like they care if there are any witnesses.
Then you want to spoil their fun, I see.
Juan shot him a lopsided grin.
Have you ever known me to not stick my nose in other people's business?
Offhand? No.
Max was looking at the view screen and cursed. The yacht had put on a burst of speed and autofire raked the Penguin, tearing chunks of wood from her thick stern and shattering the glass panel on the door to her below deck's cabin. Sloan was protected by the transom, but the captain and another man on the bridge were horribly exposed. Trading speed for protection, the Namibian skipper began to weave his boat as they careened toward the oncoming freighter, slewing it from side to side as he tried to throw off the gunman's aim. Sloan added her own contribution by firing both barrels again. The shots were so off target that she never saw the little geysers where they hit the sea. A fresh burst from the yacht forced her down. From her vantage on the rough plank flooring of the aft deck, she couldn't see the freighter, but the boat behaved differently as it encountered waves that had been disrupted by her massive hull. Her shoulder aching from firing the gun, she knew it was now up to the Penguin's captain and the mysterious master of the Oregon. She lay against the transom, panting with fear, tinged with exhilaration. The same sense of defiance that had put her in the predicament in the first place. Back aboard the Oregon, Juan and Max watched the two small craft coming closer. The Penguin's skipper was keeping her on track to race down the starboard side, with the yacht actually running a bit further to the right and fast approaching the range where the gunners would have their quarry dead to rights.
"Wait for it," Max said to no one in particular.
Had he been in charge of this situation, he would have told Sloan to stand by the radio and given the order to turn himself. Then he realized Juan had been right to let the skipper make the call. He knew his boat's capabilities and would know when to make the cut. The Penguin was 30 yards from the Oregon, so close that the mast camera could no longer track her. The weapons officer switched to the gun camera on the bow 30 caliber. The little boat was raked with yet another burst of fire from the yacht, and had they been further away, Juan would have abandoned his plan and blown the luxury craft out of the water with either the .30 caliber or the Gatling gun that was still tracking the target, even hidden behind her steel plating. "Now," he whispered. Though Cabrillo hadn't activated his microphone, it was as if the Penguin's captain heard him. He cut the wheel hard to the left just 15 yards from the knife-edge prow of the Oregon, riding up on the swell that curled away from her hull like a surfer catching a wave. The helmsman on the yacht jerked the wheel as if to follow, then corrected his course when he realized they were going too fast to stay on the Penguin's tail. He'd passed the freighter down her starboard side and, using his superior speed, reached the stern abreast of his target. "Helm," Juan said calmly. "On my mark, I want bow thrusters to starboard at full power and give me right full rudder. Increase speed to 40 knots. Juan clicked through camera angles until he caught a glimpse of the Penguin. He had to make sure she didn't get crushed as he made his turn. He expertly judged speeds and angles, knowing he was risking lives to preserve his ship's secrets. The yacht was almost in position, the Penguin almost out of danger, but time had run out. Mark. With just the click of a few keys and a subtle twist of a joystick, the 11,000-ton ship did something no other vessel its size was capable of. The athwartship thrusters came to life, forcing the Oregon's bow laterally through the water, fighting the inertia of her own speed and the increased thrust of her magneto-hydrodynamic engines as they ramped up even faster. 1 second, the yacht and the freighter were running parallel, if opposite courses, and the next, the Oregon had turned 45 degrees, and rather than racing down her long flank, the yacht was headed directly for her bow at a combined closing speed of 60 knots. Like a whale protecting its young, Juan had put his ship between the yacht and the charter boat. He glanced at the screen showing the Penguin. The Oregon had turned just past her, cutting through her wake and sending her bobbing on the rollers peeling off his ship. As if racing to cross train tracks ahead of a locomotive, the yacht's driver tried to beat the surging bow of the Oregon by turning to port and outrunning what he believed to be a relatively slow ship. Had he seen the boil of water erupting under her fantail, he would have cut his own engines and prayed he survived the impact with her hull. The vectors in place were a matter of simple mathematics. The Oregon continued her turn, cutting across the bow of the yacht even as it desperately tried to turn a tighter circle than the freighter. At the last moment, one of the gunmen on the yacht lunged forward to yank back the throttles, but the gesture was too little too late. The gleaming prow of the yacht slammed into the Oregon's scaly hull 100 feet from her bow. Fiberglass and aluminum were no match for the old ship's tough hide, and the luxury boat accordioned like a beer can hit with a sledgehammer. Her twin turbo diesels were ripped from their mounts and tore through her hull, shattering the structural ribs that held the boat together. In a burst of glass and plastic shards, the vessel's upper works came apart as if she'd exploded. The four men who were confident moments earlier that they would complete their mission died instantly, crushed into oblivion by the tremendous force of the crash. One of her fuel tanks exploded in a rising ball of dirty orange flame that licked the Oregon's rail as she continued to turn, as unaffected by the impact as if she were a shark being charged by a goldfish. A spreading pool of burning diesel coated the ocean, giving off clouds of greasy smoke that obscured the remains of the yacht in her final moments before she slipped below the waves. "All stop," Cabrillo ordered, and felt the instant deceleration as the pump jets were disengaged. "Like swatting flies," Max said and patted Juan's shoulder. "Let's just hope all that wasn't to protect a hornet." He hit his microphone switch. "Oregon calling Penguin. Do you copy?" "Oregon, this is the Penguin. They could almost hear Sloane's relieved smile over the comlink.
I don't know how you did that, but you've got three very grateful people here.
It would be my pleasure to have you and your shipmates aboard for a late lunch to talk about what just happened.
Wait 1 minute, please, Oregon.
Juan needed to know what had just occurred and wasn't going to give her the time to come up with a cover story.
If you don't accept my invitation, I will have no choice but to file a formal report with the maritime authorities at Walvis Bay.
He had no such intention, but Sloane didn't know that.
In that case, we would love to accept your offer.
Very well. My boarding ladder is extended on the port side. A crewman will escort you to the bridge.
Juan looked at Max.
Well, let's go see what another fine mess I've gotten us in, Ollie.